I think for me, being dangerous is about going out of your comfort zone and loving being stretched and being out of that zone. For me, I'm very ambitious for myself professionally and also the people that I look after, whether that be staff or students. And I think it's about teaching them that being dangerous is a really positive word. To see how the girls interact with each other, the freedom they have to be themselves, to just ask questions without any sense of, oh, what is someone going to think about me? What's someone going to look? There's no judgment. There's no sense of, I've got to dress like this, I've got to be like this. And so I just think it's magic.
Our podcast claims the Dangerous Women mantle one incredible dangerous woman at a time. The Dangerous Women Collective is a community of professional women where achievement is celebrated, mutual support is unquestioned, and women's contribution to economic, social, and technical progress is championed. The Dangerous Women Collective podcast is the public voice of our community. It's a forum to hold in-depth conversations with brilliant women who have strong stories to share about how they have navigated the world of work and life and what we can do to lift one another up. And Dangerous Women know, as well as anyone, that we live in an increasingly fractured and targeted world, and how important it is to protect ourselves on and offline. That's why we are honoured to announce ESET as our new sponsor. As one of the world's leading cybersecurity brands and Europe's top vendor, trusted by over 500,000 businesses worldwide, we know we're in safe hands. We will be hearing more from ESET as the series progresses. And of course, their fabulously dangerous UK head of marketing, Jules Berriff, appeared on Series 2. In Series 3, we will continue to explore the careers and stories of eight of the most dangerous women around. From menopause advisors to agency founders, women sharing their stories of resurgence after redundancy, and leaders of world-famous businesses. Their stories shed light on winning in today's world, with both zest and style, often in extraordinarily complicated circumstances. Their lead-by-example fearlessness is both inclusive and empowering. Dangerous women share their tales of daring do to inspire and engage everyone who recognises the power of zig versus zag. We dare you to listen. I am delighted to introduce you to Liz Gregory, head of the Maynard School, an all-girls independent school based in Exeter. It educates girls from preschool to A-level leavers and was voted the top school in the Southwest by the Times and Sunday Times this year and is considered to be one of the top 100 best schools in the country, also ranked by the Times and Sunday Times. I'm also proud to say this is the school both my girls completed their A-levels in, one now happily in her second year of uni, and the first, at the time of recording, more stressfully right in the middle of taking them. Both loved their time at the Maynard and have jumped happily from co-ed into single sex and carry the Maynard with them everywhere they go. So with all of that in mind, this episode is going to be a little different, a special if you will, all about how we educate dangerous women, what sets up girls for a life of success, whatever success looks like, and how we bake that in from the get-go, and as an all-female, from a pupil point of view, the best start for dangerousness. But first, let me introduce Liz to you. Following a state education, Liz studied economics at Reading, fully intending to enter the world of finance. Quickly realising this is not where her passions lay, Liz returned to university for her PGSE, quickly realising how much she loved teaching. She started her teaching career in mainstream, inclusive state schools in Warwickshire and Derbyshire, before heading south to accept a position in an all-girls boarding house at King's College Taunton. She is also president-elect of the Chartered College of Teaching. The Maynard is her first all-girls school and her first headship, so who better to talk to about educating dangerous girls than Liz? Of course, we might discuss private versus state, the current VAT issues, and of course, boys versus girls in the classroom as well. So Liz, thank you so much for joining us today. I can't wait to get stuck in. I've really headlined your story. Perhaps you could talk about your journey through education and your move into private girls' schools yourself. So how did you get here today?
Oh, well, Sophie, thank you so much for inviting me to be on the podcast. It's a real privilege and great fun to have the chance to do it. As you said, I went to a state school, I was state educated, but interestingly, my sister wasn't. So we didn't go to the same schools. She went to a private school because for her, her SEND needs required her to do that. Whereas for me, I was very happily going on to a state school. And I had to admit, I had a really wonderful time. I think partly that was because of the friends I had. I had three really good friends who I met on my first day of school, and too many years later, we are still really good friends now. And that for me made school a really special place. And we had a great time and worked really hard and did really, really good things because I benefited from my education. I found going into then a maintained sector school as a teacher really natural. And it made sense for me to want to be there, almost to give back to what I'd done. But as you've already said, I didn't start thinking I would want to be a teacher. I started thinking I would go into the world of finance. I love maths. I really enjoyed a sense of applied maths, and that's why I did economics at university. Having gone through things like Bank of England and KPMG and done a bit of an internship, just wasn't feeling the love. Wasn't for me.
Not giving you fire.
Not giving me fire. No, exactly that. I'm quite an active person. I don't sit still very long. My PA would say she has to chip at me so she knows where I am. So the thought of being in a desk or being in an office environment just, yeah, wasn't feeling the love. So I thought, well, what do I do instead? And when I was revising for my finals, one of my friends said, well, you love helping. Have you thought about teaching? And I thought, okay, well, yeah, I'll give that a thought. I was going to do a gap year anyway, and that gap year was going to be teaching English in Bangkok. So I went to do that for a year. Really, really clicked. Love that I thought of that. You know, it's a bit of a cliche, but you see those light bulb moments, you see the children's eyes lighting up, and it just, yeah, forevermore has been the best job in the world for me.
Amazing. So you came back from Bangkok, went straight into your PGSE. Your first teaching was in an all-inclusive state school, which is probably quite different from we're sitting in the school today in the Maynard. Tell me about that. How long are you in mainstream education as a teacher for?
So in total, I was in mainstream education for 11 years.
That was
two schools, a chunk. Yeah. We really learn your craft as an NQT as well when I first started. Both were big comprehensives, real mix intake from, well, behavioural difficulties that you had to learn those techniques, those tools and build those relationships all the way actually in Derbyshire, real mix, because you had people with quite a bit of money all the way down to people who had very, very little and very different family setups. So you learn what it is to be a teacher, I think, in those kind of difficult or challenging environments.
And actually, I was a governor of an all-inclusive state school fairly near here for 7 years. It's the diversity of what you need to get the kids to do that's so interesting there. So that's not to say there's not issues in any school, but for some children just turning up every day was a huge achievement, and for some children getting 3A stars and going on to Oxford and Cambridge was a huge achievement. And for teachers to having to manage that breadth in the classroom, it's a phenomenal task. It's not just about teaching, I think. It's about preparing in a lot of ways, isn't it?
And relationship building.
Yeah.
And knowing what is reasonable for that particular child and their family setup. And the more you spend time with them and give them your time, the more they know. I mean, this is the same for any child, but perhaps more particularly for a child where they come from a more challenging background. If they know you have their back and you're there for them and you
trust.
Want to know that you build that trust, that's the first thing to do. And that's where you get the wins.
Yeah.
And you learn the buttons to press that gets the best out of them.
So what made you make the leap from that style of education into private? So after that, did you come down to Taunton at that point?
Was it. Yeah. And actually, to be honest, I found that challenging at the time. And it was very much because my husband's job changed.
Oh, okay.
And so we moved from Nottingham, where we were living, down to Bristol. And I was searching for work and Taunton came up. So
it's slightly, I mean, I don't want to, but happenstance. It was right place, right time.
Absolutely that, yes.
How interesting. So when you walked into Taunton, which is, again, it's a big, successful private school down here in the West Country, co-ed, but boarding, which the Maynard is not. So how did that feel? Did you suddenly feel sort of a bit, I don't know, what's the word, chariots of fire, you know, sort of ivory tower-ish?
Yes, I think I did for the first couple of days because I wasn't quite sure the terminology that was used or the setup that was used. It was my first boarding experience. So I was like, where do the children go at the end of the day? They go to these boarding houses and how does that all work? People were just so lovely and welcoming and I couldn't have been more welcomed, actually. And I made some great friends who I still contact with now. And the children...
Was there a big difference? Was there a different focus?
There's a bit of a focus that's different because they're not at home.
Yeah.
And so you become locus parentis, particularly as I got more involved in boarding. I was part of a boarding house. So there is a difference in that. And the partial need can be different, again, because they're not at home, perhaps. Or home can look different. Or they're international students, which I hadn't come across before.
Yeah.
So that, by the very nature of being away, overseas and away from home, and perhaps their cultural background themselves and their family life, that can lead to challenges that I hadn't come across and having to get to know them in a different way. It takes a little while to find your feet, but I loved it.
It's easy to say this, isn't it? But privilege doesn't necessarily equate happiness. So those basic confidence skills are universal, I think. You might deal with them in different ways, but as you said, children are children, so that's really powerful. Was it at Taunton that you decided you wanted to be a senior teacher or start gunning for head? When did that, because that's, again, not every teacher wants to remove themselves from teaching in some respects and become a leader.
I think the seed had been sown when I became head of department, but I don't think I quite appreciated where I was going to find myself until, yes, I got to Taunton and I had the chance to be assistant head there. And I was my focus there was on teaching and learning. Mm-hmm. And that was brilliant because I could then really make a difference in a way that I couldn't do as a middle leader. And I think that was then when I was like, oh, I was watching other people doing their roles and thinking, I could do that. And I would like to do that. And I would like the autonomy to do that. And so then I started looking at deputy head academic roles, mm-hmm. which is then when I moved on to that. And that then became a senior deputy role. And finally, then I'm here at the Maynard as head. And teaching is, when I was a teacher, I thought that was the best job in the world. And I really miss how much time I don't get to be in the classroom any longer. But, oh, I love being head. Because the influence you can have, the culture you can help create, it's wonderful.
So, yes, well, okay, and I would say this, everyone, because I'm biased, and probably Liz is biased too, but the Maynard is a very special place, arguably one of the oldest girls' schools in the country, certainly fighting one or two other schools for the monkey egg. And as I said, just been, well, you've been head for 3 years now, God, time flies. In that time, the school has become, you know, literally one of the best schools in the country and the best school in the Southwest, bar none. So that's state and private, co-ed, not mixed. So a girls' school is championed with some pretty phenomenal write-ups. So you must be, not validated your move, but it must be a lovely way to start a job.
It really does make you go, okay, this is working. Yeah. Whatever we're doing, this is going well.
Don't change it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That. Keep it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really does. And to have that accolade after 2 years of being here and to go, okay, so the initiatives we've been putting in and the drive we've been really instilling to raise those standards and to really, I hope the teachers to feel equipped and enabled to be the best versions of themselves in the classroom and to be free to be the wonderful professionals that they are and take the girls beyond the curriculum and to really stretch and challenge or support as and when necessary.
Yeah.
That's the proof is in the pudding, isn't it? That those results say it all.
They absolutely do. Well, so we're in a sort of difficult time for private schools, aren't we? With the VAT has come in since Christmas, the VAT hike. We can talk about it a bit later. I'm in two minds about it. I get it, but it's been managed in a very rushed way.
It's been an interesting time.
Yeah, so it's difficult. Has the Sunday Times recognition helped counterbalance that, do you think?
I would hope so. Mm. I don't think anyone's, in fact, I can't remember anyone telling me explicitly that it has, but I do know that people have, as sort of said, it's great that we're here at such a wonderful school and great that we're here at a school that will enable our girls to get the best A-level and or GCSE grades that they possibly can. And that all comes down to them knowing the calibre of the school that we are and the calibre of the staff that we have and the environment that creates and enables the girls to achieve those results that got us those awards. So I do think it helps to counterbalance because, yes, it's been VAT for all independent schools has been really, really tough, really challenging in terms of many, many aspects of it. And I'm sure we'll come back to that later.
It's just so interesting.
It's fascinating in terms of just, if you sort of step back and reflect on it, think about it as a project to roll out, it is fascinating. But I think it has encouraged some to stay, mm-hmm. perhaps who wouldn't have done otherwise. And I think it has attracted ones to want to come to us.
The recognition. Not the VAT.
Not the VAT. No, definitely not. But the recognition where maybe with the VAT, they might have thought twice beforehand, but the recognition has said to them, no, this is a great school. We really want to make it work.
Parents are choosing to make an investment. It just happens to be in their children's education rather than other things. And for a lot of parents, including me, you know, there were some sacrifices that had to be made. Yeah. And it's a choice you make. So, yes, as I said, we'll come on to the VAT later. But I think so. Before we move on to danger, how do you find being in an all-girls school?
I think it's the best thing you can do. I really do. I don't think there's no reason other than it being a really good setup for why out of the top 100 schools in the country, about 20 of them are all girls' schools. And it that to me says quite a lot, quite a powerful thing. And then you walk around the school and you get the feel for it. And
by the way, in that list, not all were fee paying. Well, some are selective.
Some are selective.
But not all are fee paying. I think that's really interesting as well.
Yes, very much so. Mm. And I think you sort of see how the girls interact with each other, the freedom they have to be themselves and then to just ask questions without any sense of, oh, what is someone going to think about me? What's someone going to look? There's no judgment. There's no sense of, I've got to dress like this. I've got to be like this. And so I just think it's magic. It's absolutely brilliant to be part of it.
But the girls here, who are beautiful, by the way, inside and out, but often look quite shabby when they're at school.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, there's very much a flip-flop tracksuit t-shirt vibe rocking at the moment. And I love that because it means they're just focusing on who they are, not what they're wearing and what they are doing. And I don't think in a mixed environment that would ever, ever happen.
Well, I can tell you it doesn't because I've been in it.
Yeah, it doesn't. it doesn't.
It's so more, it's very powerful. What's my mascara looking like or what am I wearing today?
They're amazing. So they're focused on what they need to be focusing on, which is amazing. So, Liz, do you consider yourself to be dangerous? And how important do you think it is for women to be dangerous in today's world?
So yes, I do, because I think for me, being dangerous is about going out of your comfort zone and loving being stretched and being out of that zone. And for me, I'm very ambitious for myself professionally and also the people that I look after, whether that be staff or students. And I think it's about teaching them or role modelling to them that being dangerous is a really positive word.
Yes.
And it can look like whatever it is for them. But fundamentally, it's about saying yes to something and trying and having a go and thinking, oh, I could do that. I could put myself forward for that. Give that a go. Why not? Trying to do this podcast is a little bit me going, I'll give that a go because I've not done this before. And you mentioned
nailing
in your introduction.
It. So well done.
Thank you very much. That's very kind. But you mentioned in your introduction that I'm now co-president-elect for the Chartered College of Teaching and putting myself forward with that, thinking, well, I'm not going to lose anything if I don't try. And if I don't get it, well, I'm in the same position I was before. So let's give it a go. And I got it. So I think it's about doing that. And by doing that, you make the world hopefully a better place.
Agree. It's very interesting because, and I keep saying this on every podcast because I haven't done it yet, but I'm pulling together an anatomy of a dangerous woman that I think I'm going to make into an article or something. And there are things that come out in every podcast. There's ones you expect, like being resilient and not being afraid and da da da. But one that comes out time and time again is that women who grab opportunities in front of them that may not have been there the day before, and they maybe pivot very easily to lean into things and opportunities that are ahead of them. And what I'm hearing from you is that the girls in this school are sort of encouraged to do that from the get-go.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it can be very difficult. It can be very, very difficult if you're on, if you've got responsibilities, if you're a working mum and, you know, and suddenly going, okay, boom, I'm going to jump into this next opportunity. Isn't that easy? But it is often makes a career or a life. So it needs some real grist to be able to do it, I think. And you're teaching that from an early age.
And I think that's the thing, isn't it? That it goes back to that statistic of men will apply for a job that they're sort of, 40%, 50% qualified for, ready for, but I'll still give it a go. Whereas women will want to be like, oh, now I'm going to tick through all the job description and make sure I can do absolutely everything. It's like, no, just try.
I know.
Put your hand in the ring. Doesn't matter. Be confident about it or fake it till you make it. And actually, you'll come across really well and you can learn on the job. You're not going to be perfect straight away.
We're not. Unfortunately, girls, I think, are, and this is probably changing, but I, we're certainly taught to be perfect from a young age in a way that boys perhaps weren't. So they could go out and get dirty. And this is shifting for sure. But our generation or my generation, I think I'm older than you, but you were supposed to be perfect. So then suddenly you're told you don't need to be perfect to do this next thing is, again, quite a mind shift.
Really hard to change
those patterns.
Yeah, which is why I think role modelling it within a school sets that tone, doesn't it, from the get-go. So we've got, we've got four-year-olds all the way through to 18-year-olds in this school, and that role modelling happens through staff, but also the older girls modelling to the younger ones, because the younger ones look up to the older girls so much. And so if we can enable the environment to be where our older ones are really free and can pivot and can show that adaptability, then it just becomes what the younger ones expect life to be like.
Yeah.
And they just learn it.
So I think we've touched on Maynard absolutely does foster dangerousness. And dangerous doesn't mean, harming yourself, everybody, just to remind you. It's about the zig versus zag.
Absolutely.
Zag when you should zig kind of ethos of living. How important do you think that is in today, particularly this generation coming out of school? How important it is to have that sort of, it's almost a more entrepreneurial way of thinking, isn't it?
I think it's probably the most important it's ever been. And I think AI is playing a part in that.
Yeah.
And interestingly, over the last week or two, there's been some really, really fascinating articles in the news around the need to adapt and the need to be flexible. And this, the current generation coming into the world of work and the ones following on behind, they need to be able to flex and adapt and have those World Economic Forum 2030 skills about being nimble, about being quick-minded, about questioning, about being critical. They will need to do quick step changes and go, okay, this is the direction of travel now, off I go. I need to go that way, rather than assuming, I've got a job, Wonderful, thank you very much. And it's my job for life. Well, that just isn't the case. And people are trained in their careers now in their 30s and their 40s and doing, well, I'll just do this instead. And they're retraining. But that takes some courage, I think. And that's another skill, I think, well, characteristic, I suppose, more than a skill that we need young people to have. Mm. The courage to go, well, I don't know what my income's going to be because I need to change career or I need to shift, but I'm going to take that plunge and have a go anyway.
These children in the last 6 years, obviously, where are we, 5 years, have been more affected by the pandemic than anybody else. So that's, anyway, that's what I think. Anybody who's a school age, and you notice it in schools, there is a difference in children. I guess how much important is teaching resilience in school now? And is that a conscious thing?
It is a conscious thing. I think resilience, grit, I mean, one of our values, as you know, the school is courage.
Yeah.
And which I sort of wrap up into, to those sorts of things. And I think it is really important. And they, yes, they have had a really hard time. And I see it even in our year sixes coming through now to our year sevens in September.
So just for everybody who's forgotten, that's going up to senior school, because we forget so quickly.
You're right. We really do. And if you haven't got your own children, then it's been your own year groups, isn't it? So you take a bit of time to remember, perhaps. But they were really little during COVID.
Yeah.
And so they didn't have those opportunities to learn perhaps those social behaviours and those norms. And they've had to take time to develop those at a point where they would normally have had them. So I still think we've got some years to work through of a COVID overhang.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't want to go. We're not going to go down that road, but it is interesting because we're in that cohort, I guess, of kids at the moment.
Yeah.
What are the key responsibilities of Maynard, do you think, to prepare girls, or any school actually, to prepare girls for the outside world? We've touched on a few, but what would you say?
One example is coming to mind. So I did a wonderful thing with our upper six, which, well, I think it was lovely. I enjoyed it. Whether they've benefited from it or not, I'll leave them to tell me that. But I called it Living Authentically. And it was a series which was in the morning with them. And I did it because I wanted to just discuss with them and share with them my thoughts about being a young woman in the world. Now, I've read books by Mary Seagulls called The Authority Gap.
Oh, that's one of my... I mentioned it almost...
It on my shelf right
almost
now.
Almost every episode. It has become my touchstone because there's so much evidence in that book that it's a very evident, it's almost scientific.
Yes.
It is different for women than men in the workplace. It just is.
Just is. Yep. And I wanted the girls to be cognizant of that, but also to have prepared themselves mentally for it because they don't have that in this environment. And I wanted them to be also very aware of the privilege they've had of being in this environment.
Yeah.
So I talked to them about a phrase of sending the elevator back down, because for them, they will think nothing of asking a question in a conference or in a meeting or being confident to speak in a seminar or just to go out and have a go, as we said before, about being adaptable or having the courage to try things. But other girls won't have been in that environment. And I notice it in conferences when I attend that women are less likely to ask a question or go up to the speaker at the end and share LinkedIn connections and start networking, and then who knows where that goes.
Yeah.
Whereas men will do that more naturally, at least that's what I've seen. And where our girls will do that, they're confident to speak to young strangers and people they've never met before. So I think they have a responsibility to encourage others to do that. And if they're the ones first asking a question in the conference, for example, they will encourage other girls, other women, to say, oh, it's okay for me to ask a question. That question was something I was also thinking of. I'll put my hand up. I'll have a go. Or I'll go and speak to the speaker at the end and I'll start networking, or I'll get on LinkedIn and I'll have a little go at building my own brand and doing that, which we know is how things operate really these days, isn't it? About having your own personal brand.
Yes.
and having those social connections and that social cachet, if you like. So I think sending the elevator back down, recognising the privilege they've had, is something that we should be doing.
You've talked about something inspirational with the talks that you did, but actually I know, because both my girls have done them, things like doing assemblies, like delivering assemblies, or at Maynard they have a head girl team rather than just one head girl team who talk to parents. So they're sort of by stealth forced on stage to do those things, and then you build up muscle memory, so it's not so hard later down the line. So I think there's, even those small that probably seem small and very into school, have trails that leave, you know, go on much wider than what happens in the school setting, which is really powerful.
Yeah, I think so.
I remember a colleague once saying that she was very cross with her father because he told her she could be anything. She's one of the most impressive women I've ever met. Terrifying, but impressive. But when she got out into the big, wild, bad world, she realised that as a woman, that wasn't the case. I wonder if you think that's still true. And does the school help mitigate for things like that as well, the realities of what it's like out there?
I think it is, sadly, still true. I think it's less than it was, and I have real hope that it's moving in the right direction. But I think sometimes it feels a bit like you're going two steps forward and one step back, but that is still progress, gradual but progress. And it goes back actually to the authority gap book that it demonstrates in there that the gaps exist, otherwise why write a book? And I think that's how we, well, one way in which we help the girls to realise that the world is a bit like that. And we do that through PSHE, we do that through...
What's PSHE?
Yes, good question. So PSHE is Personal Health and Social Education.
Yeah.
So it's all that stuff about how do you manage your money, but also women's health and how do you just, you know, go out to the world and... Be a healthy citizen.
And I understand they're bringing menopause into this, which I'm very excited about. Well done.
Yeah.
I am 55, so I'm sort of thinking about it quite a lot now, but it's brilliant. So yeah, it's very expansive, PSHE, isn't
it? Very much so, very much so. It's all about preparing you for the world outside of the Maynard or any school. And that's a really good vehicle for helping them to appreciate that it won't be straightforward.
Yeah.
And they might find microaggressions, or they might find things are really tricky, or they might find that there's barriers that they're not accustomed to having to push through or overcome. So through PSHE we discuss those sorts of things, the Living Authentically series that we did, but also trying to put conferences on or getting to attend conferences that are co-ed, if you like. And so they will go to MUN conferences, which is Model United Nations, where they will interact with boys there. We did a Speak Out conference a couple of years ago, and that was done with other maintained sector schools in the area. So helping them to learn to interact with the other sex, therefore knowing that it won't be the same.
No.
And so how do we build those skills up now?
Because it is a bubble. It's an excellent bubble, but it's still a bubble here, isn't it? Yeah.
Which is
brilliant. Okay, so back to that maintained state versus private. Arguably, is it more dangerous to be ahead at a big, inclusive state school? What do you think about that?
It's
hard. You've done both, I think.
Yeah.
You've not headed into
not
state school. No.
But have done leadership within. Mm. And I have really close colleagues who, again, through Charter College, and also because I'm a governor of a state maintained school in Bristol, I see what the principal there has to do. And it's tough. It's really tough. And I think she does an incredibly good job. But I think it's just different, because for me, I need to manage the education piece, but I also need to manage the HR, the employment, the manage finances. I don't have anyone else to go to. It's only to a business leader.
Jeez.
Yeah.
No.
As well as an educationalist.
Yeah.
So it's me and my show governors, and we run this, you know, essentially. Mm. Running the school. So I think that in that respect, having to learn all the aspects of running a business while also not having to say that background and being an economist helps a bit.
Mm.
But I think that has an element of danger to it. They're both challenging, but perhaps different feel.
100%. And also, I mean, not that you have to justify anything, but there's a, you know, in the world we live in today where everything's under a microscope and everybody, you know, and you'll get cancelled in a second. Justify is the wrong word, but you have to explain why there's a place for the Maynard and why it's a good thing and why children should come here. And you know, and that's not always the easiest argument. I mean, it is when you see the school, but you know, for people who don't believe in fee paying, you know, you're always going to be up against that.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
It's really interesting. So we've touched on this a little bit already, but what does the Maynard do to make sure the girls here are aware of, I guess, their privilege, which feels very heavy, I don't mean, but to have, you know, understand that it's a big wide world out there. And when they go back into the big wide world, they're going to encounter all those people and more. You talk about role modelling within the school, but do you do that with that outside the school as well?
Yeah. So community is a really big thing for us, and we do it throughout every single year group. So one lovely example that one of my associate SLT has just been running with, this is his baby. He's asked some of our sixth formers to volunteer to mentor girls who are in the maintained school just down the road from us. And so we have, on a Friday morning, we have a group of our sixth formers, it's about 15 of them, and they are on teams and they are teaching a year 10 student or sometimes a year 11, helping them to overcome challenges they might have on a particular subject. And we were inundated by girls wanting to help do that.
Amazing.
And we've got one particular pupil who's really connected with her mentee. Her mentee is selectively mute, but is actually talking to our girl who's the mentor. It's just phenomenal.
That's goosebump stuff, right?
Totally goosebump stuff.
Yeah.
How magical it is. And we do a monitoring and evaluation thing of it. And every single one who's answered that said, my confidence is boomed since I've had that person to talk me through that subject I've been really struggling with. So that has been marvellous to show there's a bigger world out there and the privilege they have here, and they can then use that to help others.
Sort of paying danger forward a little bit, which is
very much that.
Really. Well, I'll tell you, I mean, a little story. So my oldest daughter, Daisy, came to Maynard. The reason she came to Maynard is because when she was at, they did their first 5 years at a local very nice state school, they loved. But she came to a science day at the Maynard. It blew her away. And she came home, and I think there was 8 of them from the school who came. Anyway, she came home and she goes, I am going to the Maynard for A levels. And I went, all right, darling, when you have to get a scholarship. That was just an immediate reaction. Anyway, she did. And she came here and she loved it. But days like that reverse expose children to also of what opportunities there could be. Not that they have to go to private school, but if, you know, what else is out there rather than maybe what they see day in, day out.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It might be the Year 10 STEM Day that she came on.
We've been doing
that for a little while.
Yes.
Yes, it's a whole day run by, well, we facilitate it, and we get our alumni come back and they talk about their careers in science as well. And the girls, last year, they were building models of an electric car. And it takes them a whole day to do this. And it's loads of other things they learn, science, teamworking, innovation, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, they get to come to the Maynard, and about 15 schools will send a little delegation.
Yeah.
And they come away. And the recruitment we get from that is really great because it inspires the girls to want to have the opportunities.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant and expensive, but brilliant. No, worth every single penny. One of the joys of a private school as well, and I know this from my all girls boarding school, is the power of the alumni. And I wondered, how does that work here? I've seen some of it in action. And I think also a lot of the girls, I know there's girls from my school, I was trying to think of examples, but I've totally forgotten her name, so I might have to put it in the show notes at the end. It's Vicky, and I can't remember the last name. She was the very first journalist. She was a Vanity Fair journalist, and she broke the Jeffrey Epstein story before anybody else did. Now, you know, that took guts and fortitude and deep self-belief. I suspect many of those traits started at our school, which was a bit like here, very, you know, you could be anything and do anything kind of school. But if you can think of it, inspirational Maynardians, and how does your alumni network work as well?
So we did a wonderful, my head of marketing did an amazing project 2 years ago now called Going Places. Mm. And it was all about celebrating what our alumni have achieved over the years. And we've got so many people saying, we want to be part of it, that we've now got a second and a third series
Amazing.
About to come out. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
And it's a whole range of, from sciences through to arts, humanities, all sorts of things. So we have a BAFTA-winning film producer, we've got award-winning podcasters, we've got award-winning writers, but we've also got wine traders those in the financial markets. We've got an Atlantic rower as well who
Amazing.
Came back to speak to the girls. We've got one of our alumni left about 5 years ago. She's down in Plymouth and working for a space centre down there. And then our current upper sixth, we've got one who was named by Bupa as the one to watch nationally, as a woman to watch. And we've got one who's going off to see the Kennedy International Space Centre in July.
Wow.
Because she won a competition as part of the Space Settlement Design Centre. So you just think it's incredible what they actually managed to
and
achieve.
And is it a live, active network that sort of supports one another?
Yeah, it is. It really is. And increasingly so, because we've put lots of energy into it over the last 3 years since I've been here, really wanting to invigorate it again and helping them to network and using our alumni to mentor the current girls as well, to help them know how to get those internships or how to do those interviews for university places.
So I think there's two things there, isn't there? One, any group of impressive women is a great thing to belong to, because women are very good at, not all, but in general, they're very good at sharing swapping. And that's what Dangerous Women is all about as well. It's hijacking that concept and making it our own. And the other reason it's very good is that you don't have had to be at school with one another to help one another. It's a very weird thing, I think, that the school keeps you wrapped in its arms long after you've left. Again, not everybody, but it's there if you need it. My school does it. I know the Maynard does it. And, you know, I don't know if that would happen in a not all girls school in quite the same way. Perhaps it would. Perhaps I'm being unfair. But we have get togethers often from my school, and they're very powerful, and everyone's happy to talk, even if you didn't know them.
I think the allegiance to your school is something that's really quite special and unique to the independent sector.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think girls' schools are very good at that sense of for us, once you're a Maynardian, you're always a Maynardian. And we see it with our staff too. We have a staff alumni group, because they just can't bear to depart from the school and they keep wanting to come back. It's really quite magic.
Yeah, amazing. What would you tell your younger self about the power of being dangerous?
So I think two things. A, that, as I said before, about saying yes. Mm-hmm. And going for it and trying for that, which is something I think I've always naturally had in me because of how I see the world. But On top of that, I would say you only get this day once, so make the most of it. And that's something I really kind of reflected on as I've got older and seen family members and other people, you know, that sadness that unfortunately you don't get to keep your family members forever.
No.
Or friends forever, sadly, either. You get this one day, make it special, because you only get to live this particular day on the 6th of June or whatever today's date is.
5th, I think.
Fifth.
And it becomes far more powerful the older you get,
yeah.
I think. So it would be interesting to tell. I don't know how you imbue that. Maybe you shouldn't imbue it to younger people. Maybe they shouldn't have to worry about it yet. But there's David Bowie, as he was getting older, used to sort of find himself at his most creative because his time was tighter. So why waste a second of it? And I think, particularly for women who maybe have taken on multiple roles and, you know, as you come into your 50s plus, to seize every day and know that you're perhaps at your prime of creativity is a very powerful thing to know about yourself.
Mm. Yeah, and I love being in my 40s. And yep. it was never anything that worried me or made me sort of feel, oh, why am I in my 40s? I love it because I feel wiser. I feel more experienced. I feel more confident in who I am, more settled in just being me. It's great.
Yeah, actually, I've really enjoyed 50s, which I didn't expect. Although I'm about to be 55, and that's a whole nother age bracket on those, which
that's
is very
such
annoying.
Bit, isn't it?
That's the only bad bit so far. Yeah, no, exactly. Would you give that girl your advice to yourself, to the Maynard girls?
Yeah. Definitely, and have done.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So we've talked about this a little bit at the upfront, but we are facing a pretty tough time in education in general. I am not an expert, you are, so I'm going to ask you the questions, but just looking at it from afar, you know, VAT is hitting parents, and I'm not across the private sector, I don't just mean at the Maynard, and it doesn't seem to be benefiting the state sector particularly at the moment either. It seems to be a very political move. I think conceptually I get it, like I get that we're privileged enough to be able to afford to send our children here, so why should we get a tax break on it? But it just, for me, it was rushed in. I'm sure you have a different opinion to me, so I don't not agree with it in concept, but I find it's tough how it's been rolled out. It doesn't really affect me because I'm about to end that journey. But I wonder, do you think the girls here are aware of it? Do you think state schools are feeling the pinch? I wonder what your take on it was. Just having you was a question I couldn't not ask.
No, absolutely. And I can certainly answer the last bit there about state schools feeling the pinch. Yeah. Absolutely are.
Is this because of your governing or just what you know from?
Well, governing, both? Definitely, because I know how tight budgets are for where I govern, but also through Charter College, which is a professional body for teaching. So it covers maintained and independent, everybody. And actually, I was chatting to colleagues yesterday, and it's really tough. Budgets are really, really tight. Redundancies are either having to be made or planned in the near future. I don't think that's any secret because it's been in the news a lot recently and talked to colleagues here who have perhaps members of the family who work in the maintained sector, they would say the same kind of thing. So I really feel for anybody in education at the moment, things are not plush or comfortable.
Okay. And what about, do you feel the pupils are aware of a shift, or do you try and protect them from that as much as possible?
I think it depends on their family circumstances, really. So some will be completely oblivious to it because they have the wonderful circumstances where their parents are not really affected by it. For us, in our setting, they are few and far between. I know too many families who are making really heavy sacrifices to enable their girls to stay here and are not living in big houses at all or anything like that whatsoever, but they are very much scraping to make it possible and have come and had those really difficult conversations with me. And
God, that must be tough.
We've done what we can to support them and help them, but it's really hard because we love having their girls with us and we want to enable that to be the case as much as we possibly can. But by the same token, we're a business.
Yes.
We have to run as a business because our income by and large comes from our parents. And so we have a duty of care over that
100%.
And to honour that for the good of their girls as well as all the girls in the school. So it's that really interesting balance of being a charity and having to live out our charitable duties, but also having to run as a business.
So
at
you
the same
still,
time.
Still a charity,
yeah.
Even though, okay.
Yeah, still a charity.
Right, I had missed that.
It just so gets the benefits of being a charity so much.
I found the whole Trump Harvard story really fascinating as well. And I wondered have you got a take on that and how that affects, I mean, universities here. We have a university on our doorstep here in Exeter where the Maynard is, which has a huge international population. I'm sure they're looking at it very closely as well. It feels unsettling, I guess. That's probably more unsettling for the girls than VAT.
I think so. I think it is unsettling because I don't think anyone quite knows where it's going to end up. And it says it signals quite a move or trajectory, doesn't it, of where that country might go in terms of its inclusivity of international students.
It's very protectionist, isn't it?
Very protectionist.
Horrid.
Yeah, absolutely. But I also know our universities are finding things tough too to recruit internationally. It feels to me, I think this is being an economist, it helps me see this. It feels short-sighted because of all the wonderful skills and talents that our international students bring us and how they can enhance our own industries and our own innovation and our own science and our own arts sector, etc. They bring an awful lot to the table. Why would you not want to include them? And there's studies after studies that actually say they increase productivity and there's huge gains that we get from it. So I don't understand it personally. I wouldn't advocate for it myself.
No, and it's interesting because you look at places like Oxford, Cambridge, MIT, Harvard and more. They're global institutions, and by cutting out the international nature of them, you're no longer the best of the best, which is what those institutions thrive for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Thrive on.
But it is unsettling for kids. And so that was my next question, I think, is the whole geopolitical landscape at the moment is difficult. It's frightening. I think just in the Times today, somebody was saying there's going to be poly wars, it's not easy watching the news at the moment. And I know when I was at school, we were always encouraged to read the newspapers and watch the news. And I'm afraid I'm not particularly doing that at the moment on a regular basis because it's tough. It's a tough, heavy watch. So I wonder, how do you manage that in school? Do the kids feel it?
I think they do. And I think they should. I don't think it's a bad thing for them to feel it because I think then they are aware of the current affairs and current situation. And it's about helping them to ask questions around it and to be academically curious about what's happening, but to know how to handle it. So, you know, you look at a piece of information and then you go and find out other stories around it. And so you synthesize that information rather than just taking it all on face value. It's being able to sort of step back and ask questions around it, but also not just see it as a fait accompli of, oh, this is all hopeless.
Yeah.
And goodness me, where are we going to go? I think it goes back to our early conversation around grit and resilience and adaptability and courage to A, always be hopeful that it will get better and they can play a part in making that better, it go there.
There's a burden on these kids' shoulders in a lot of ways, but and a burden, a good or bad, a load maybe is a better word, because I firmly believe that it's these children in senior school or all of them and university at the moment, this generation that have to fix the problems of the world that we've handed to them, which we have. There's no two ways about it. I mean, my own my daughter who's still at school here is, you know, you lot gnawed it up, so we've got to fix it. And I think, and also we need to prepare these girls particularly, I think, because they, you know, historically they've maybe not been part of the decision making process of the world we live in today. And I'm not saying get rid of men, because that's but bringing more diverse ways of thinking, different gender balances, different racial balance, everything we just talked about is going to help solve the problem. So I feel hope from this generation. Absolutely. And when I see girls at this school and the senior pupils at the school I was a governor at, there is hope.
Yes, I really think there is, because they want to be activists and they want to change it and they can see how they could start doing that, I think. And like you say, if you've got a variety of thinking, then you're a stronger team, aren't you?
Yeah.
You've got a whole diversity of different perspectives drawn on. And I would hope that the generations we see now coming through out of school into universities have a greater appreciation of that, whether they be boys or girls.
Yes,
and
I agree.
And the girls are better equipped at making sure their voices are heard and they are at the table. And if they are interrupted, they say, no, thank you very much. I'm still making my point and this is, I'm going to carry on and having that recognition.
No, I won't make the coffee.
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. No, I think, do you teach differently at the school, do you think, because of the uncomfortable geopolitical climate?
I don't think we teach differently, but I think we make a point of it in assemblies.
Okay, yeah.
And we make it apparent that it's out there and how they might understand it. Because it's, I think, for a young person, sometimes you can just feel swamped. Or all you get is what you read on Reddit or what you see on TikTok. And actually you're just getting snippets. And how do you then forget the full story to really fully appreciate what's happening?
I know. Well, those particular channels are very insidious now, because you press on one thing and suddenly you're flooded with it. Or even hovered over something. I mean, I'm talking, you know, recipes. I mean, it's stupid, but I love cooking. So, you know, I've hovered on, I'm now just bombarded on Insta with recipes, but you hover over something in the Gaza Strip and suddenly you're going to be bombarded with that. And that becomes a truth when, as you said, it's that curiosity, another trait of dangerous women, to discover more and really get to the bottom of it, which is so important.
Yeah, and recognise when you're in an echo chamber and find ways out of it.
100%. Okay, so advice on channeling dangerousness. And I think this is going to be interesting because I think there are often issues in the workplace, and I know you do a lot about careers and next steps and what girls are going to do once they've left school or university, whichever path they choose to take, especially when you work in engineering or the city or in finance, which are very still male dominated, getting better and better day by day, but are male dominated, which are seen as male. So things like asking for a pay rise or interviews, which I think are oddly male construct. I'm not quite sure why I think that, but that sort of one person in front of multiple people is daunting and performative. Yeah, and it's quite strange.
I think there's performative bits of a key word.
Yeah. Rooms full of senior people. Until I was 30, I dreaded walking into a room full of suits, and I think I'm a pretty tough cookie. So do you talk about that more specifically with the girls?
Yeah, we do. And we do that through, yes, our careers programme, particularly as they're moving into GCC, but even more especially as they're coming into sixth form, because obviously that's more the reality they're about to go into. Mm. So we do quite a lot of interview preparation with them, so they get accustomed to meeting with someone they don't know and talking to them in a situation where they're going to get questions fired at them in a way that they've not necessarily been able to prepare for. They get that also by doing tours. So when we have families coming to visit and touring around, the sixth formers will do those tours for us. You mentioned assemblies, so they have to speak in assemblies, have to present in those, so they learn to publicly speak. Mm. And we do things like Lambda and that sort of thing as well to help them do that. And so they're given loads of those opportunities to be just front of house. Yes, we coach them through it a little bit, but they have to just step up and get on with it. We then work with them and go, how did that work? Did it go well? What went well? What didn't? Mm. How do we do that better next time? So we help them to be self-reflective as well, and then think, okay, so the end world hasn't ended. Didn't go perfectly, perhaps, but the world hasn't ended. How do I just pick myself up and do it a little bit better next time?
Well, everything's a practice for the next time, isn't it? Everything
absolutely.
Is a practice. And I've said this to my kids all the time. Plan B is often better than plan A. So you've just got to, be able to multiple things, which luckily women are quite good at. I know Maynard does it well. My school did it well. But the girls are very good at going to teachers for help and advice. They're not frightened about being their most raw, honest selves. Maybe that's just my daughter, but I expect it's not just my daughter, which has that slight ally, sponsor, mentorship feel to it. And I think women in the workplace, particularly women who are ambitious, and you've talked about instilling ambition in the girls here. And by the way, girls, be ambitious. Don't be afraid to be ambitious.
Always.
But sponsorship and allyship is a really powerful thing. And in fact, I was even speaking to the head of a very big insurance company. So she's going to be probably, she's a big cheese. Big cheese. And she was saying until a few years ago, she was still being asked to make the coffee. And then she found a male, you know, and she's advising government ministers and stuff. Anyway, she found a male ally who when every time she was in the room, he'd say, I'll make the coffee before she did. And it's little hacks like that that I think, are getting baked, you know, you can bake in from an early age so that you know it's going to happen, but there are workarounds, and find the workaround, but also find the people that are going to be your champion.
I think it's that, isn't it? Find the people that are going to be your champion that are going to help you get there. And I had that when I was at King's, that the reason I went for the assistant head role was because the boarding house I was part of, my house mistress I worked with there was a great friend and still is a great friend. And she was the one that encouraged me to say, of course you can do it. Absolutely, you could do it. And then she saw things in me that I wasn't quite able to see myself. And then since then, I've gone, oh yeah, amazing. So and now off I go and trajectory and here I am. But having that ally, sponsor is possibly a better word for that, actually.
Well, they all do slightly
your life.
So mentorship is a very formal thing, whereas sponsorship is sort of somebody who's got your back in a way, in the same way that a school like this gives you that feeling. They've got my back if you choose to lean into that, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But also having those, since you say that ally in who will go and make the coffee before she does, or
amazing.
That person who will just spot that that's happening and therefore then jump in and go, no, that's not okay. Let's do it this way around. And I suppose that's also something I would want the girls to do in going back again to the send the elevator back down, spotting when perhaps a female colleague is not getting the fair treatment they should, and then jumping in and making it better for them.
Yeah.
Well, in whatever way that's appropriate in that setting.
And if we all did that, it would be, everything would be so much better.
Wouldn't it just?
I know. We all, and you've talked a couple of times about holding on to friends and keeping them across your life and career, which is really powerful. My best girl gang, I met on the first day of Freshers Week at uni, and we still go away 3 times a year. And I know it's lovely. So they're important people to recharge our souls and energy. These might not be the same. If you had to pick 3 people who were part of your dangerous network, they could be fictional, they can be boys, girls, whoever it wants, who might they be?
So the first one is my sister-in-law.
Okay, amazing.
She is wonderful. I met her at university. She was one of my best friends at university. Met on same halls of residence, just a corridor around from mine, and then met her brother and we got married in Westford. But she has just such intellectual curiosity and loves asking questions.
So you married, she's your sister-in-law because you're married to her brother?
Yes.
Oh, I love that. So you, she introduced you to her brother?
Yes.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. And just, she has a huge heart as well and always wants to know what she can do to help and how she can support other people. She is a surveyor and she trains others now to be surveyors. And just the story she tells, and I know how much time she gives to those that she trains up and how grateful they are for all the wonderful support she gives, but she's just a beautiful human being.
Can we say her name?
Wanda.
Wanda, well done, Wanda. Brilliant name.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I'm not quite sure
wonderful,
she thinks it's brilliant.
But I love it. Yeah.
Wanda Caulfield.
Yeah, amazing. Next.
So the next one would be Kathy Crew Reed, who is head of a school in Milan now. But when I met her, she was head of Bishop Stortford. She was my mentor when I was coming on to be a head at the Maynard. And it was one of those moments where I'll give a bit of context to why I know her. So I am part of a Women in Leadership conference sort of and mentoring program where we mentor others who want to go up in leadership in education. And through that network, I sort of said, I'm interested in headship, but not quite sure how to go about it. Would there be anyone who happy to mentor me? And Kathy said yes, she would. And she just inspired me in how to do headship really well, and how to be compassionate but also really determined and make those tough decisions when you need to and just keep that balance right, but also have a really strong sense of self as a head, and that you don't have to suddenly morph into doing headship in a particular way. Your personality can still come through and you can still do it in your own manner. You don't have to do it like your predecessor did or how someone else did it, because she's very strong in herself and her own brand, if you like, as a head. And so I found that really inspiring, and she's just awesome.
A friend, a mentor, and what's your third?
So the third is also a friend. She lives across the road from me. She's called Debbie Smith, and she has had a really, really tough time in life. She's lots of losses in her life, very, very sadly. Her courage in facing those losses and using them to the benefit of others, I just find, oh, I love it. Absolutely love it. She is training to be a counsellor. And I think that inspiration to do that came about because she wanted to, I suppose, channel her own losses, but channel what she's learned through them to benefit of others. Mm-hmm. And we were talking over the half-term break about a project that she's considering doing for her final year of her master's. And she's having to face a really tragic loss to possibly do that project on. And the fact that she's able to even consider that, knowing what she's been through, I just felt hugely humbled when we were talking about it. And I love it to bits.
Amazing. Well, three wonderful, very personal mentors, which I really like. Thank you very much. Well, it's been a brilliant conversation, Liz. Thank you so much for taking the time. We're literally in the middle of a school day. There's A-levels and GCSEs going on all around us. So I really appreciate the time. Thank you so
You're
much.
You're very welcome.
People want to find more about you or connect with you or find out more about the school, how would they do that?
So I'm on LinkedIn a lot. So
and it's Liz Gregory, isn't it? Liz.
Absolutely. Liz Gregory, FCCT and FRSA at the end. So that's a great way to find me. Yep. The school is just the Maynard. So you search for the Maynard on Google and you can find out about
100%,
us.
100%, yeah.
Yeah, if anyone wants to get in contact, I would love to hear from them.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you too, Sophie. It's been lots of fun.
I know, they always are. As a proud mother of girls, I could talk about educating women all day, and thank you so much to Liz for her insights into the responsibility she takes when it comes to preparing dangerous girls for a rapidly shifting world. Whether you are into fee-paying schools or not, there is undoubtedly a positive effect on single-sex education for women, and it's fascinating to hear about it firsthand, and to hear that dangerous traits like opportunity grabbing, resilience and curiosity are deliberately baked into school life from an early age. We ended talking about feelings of hope, and I have to say, I sense that hope when we look at the cohort of girls from this school and others coming ahead of us. As always, thank you so much for listening. It means the world that you do. Please do like, share, comment, and subscribe. And as always, stay dangerous.